I hope that we can all say that once again it is a privilege for us to be here to take another opportunity, as we did this morning, to be with those of like precious faith, knowing that there are those who are comrades in arms, it's in a spiritual sense, who are fighting the same battles that we are, facing the same temptations day after day. It is encouraging for us to know these things and that we have help one from another. And it is times such as this that as we sing songs and study God's word and worship him, that we can gain other encouragements from each other. We're glad to have all here, especially those that might be visiting with us. And we want you to know once again, you are a welcome guest here at the Knollwood congregation. If you have been before, we again are thankful for your presence. This morning we talked about that which was found in Exodus chapter 32 and 26, where Moses was talking about the children of Israel, come unto me, or come unto the Lord's side. And we talked about obedience just a little bit. Tonight we want to kind of continue that thought, continue those things that we spoke of this morning under, I guess what we might title this lesson, the cost of discipleship. If we were to take an English dictionary and look up a definition of the word disciple, we would read something like that a disciple is a learner. It is someone who is taught or trained by another individual. Again, another definition would be a pupil or a follower. And I think most of us would agree with this kind of a definition. And even in the religious sense, we would say that this would be someone who would be a disciple. That is, a person who is a follower or a learner, a person who was trained or taught by another individual. But the Bible defines for us some of those aspects of what makes a person a disciple of Jesus Christ. And since we are talking about a spiritual matter, and we are using in this context a biblical term, what we want to do is we want to allow the Bible to define for us exactly what it means to be a disciple. And you know, you can't go wrong that way. Whatever religious word you might want to define, whatever religious phrase or concept you might want to think about and try to understand, the best thing that we can do is let the Bible define that particular thing for us. If you want to know what baptism is, you don't go to the world, even the religious world. What you need to do is go to the Bible. If you want to understand all about salvation, you don't go again to the religious world. You go to the Word of God. And so if we want to know what a disciple is, we don't make up a definition of our own. What we do is we go to the Word of God, and we find out what it has to say about that particular term. And there are several passages that we want to point out in the very beginning of the lesson here that gives us some indication as to exactly what a disciple is. In Matthew chapter 10, in verse 24, and also the first part of verse 25, we find Christ here talking to his followers, his disciples, and he's warning them that there are going to be persecutions that are going to come. And he gives this an aspect of what a disciple is. He says a disciple is not above his teacher or a servant above his master. It is enough for a disciple that he be like his teacher and a servant like his master. So we see in this, he kind of tells us of what a pattern that a disciple is to follow. That is, he is to be like his teacher. He is to be one that learns from him. And he's not to strive to go beyond what the teacher is. It is enough for him to be like his teacher, to be like his master. In Luke 6 and verse 40, it says there about the same thing, a disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who is perfectly trained will be like his teacher. And so that's what we're striving to do in being a disciple of Jesus Christ, and that is to be like him. We're not striving to be more than he is, and certainly we don't want to be less than he is, although we're not going to be perfect. We're not going to be as he was, who faced sin in all forms as we do, and yet was without sin. But we strive for that, to be like him. And again, not to go beyond that one that is our teacher. In Mark 9, in verse 31, a simple statement is made. For he taught his disciples and said to them. So here's another thing that verifies what we're talking about. It says Jesus talked to his disciples. He taught them certain things, and they listened to what he had to say. In John 8 and 31, a passage that we're familiar with, "If you abide in my word, then are you my disciples indeed." So he's saying here that not only are you to listen to what I have to say, learn from me, but then abide in those things, that is, live by these things that I'm teaching you, and then you will be my disciple. So being a disciple is not just simply listening to what Christ has to say, but it's following him, abiding in his words. In John chapter 9, and as I said, we'll point out a few verses here in the beginning to give us some indication as to what we want to talk about this evening. We find that Christ had healed a blind man. And this particular individual was being questioned by the council as to what had happened to him. And in verses 27 and 28 of John chapter 9, the blind man makes this statement. He says, "I told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you not want to hear it again? Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?" He was questioning the council concerning this. You know, do you want to be his disciples? Do you want to learn from him? Do you want to follow what he has to say? And of course, their reply was, "You are his disciple, and we are Moses' disciple." They understood that. That was one who followed, one who learned. John 13 and 35. Again, another aspect. All will know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another. So here's another part of that being a disciple, and that is the love that we show one toward the other, that is manifested in our not only our words, but also in our deeds and our actions. In John 15 and verse 8, "By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit, and so you will be my disciples." We have to bear fruit. That is, the things that we learn, we must apply these things in our life and allow that fruit to come forth from these actions. In Luke 14, in verses 25 and 26 and 27, this is what we want to consider for a few moments this evening. As we find that Christ here is talking to his disciples, telling them about the things that they're going to have to do, the cost or the price that they're going to have to pay in being one of his disciples. It says there in verse 25 of Luke chapter 14, "And great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." And then he goes on in the next few verses, talking about an individual and paying the price, or what it is to be the cost that is going to have to be paid by individuals for being a disciple, one that would follow him. And that's what we want to talk for a little bit this evening about, are these two verses, verse 26 and verse 27. And one of the things that is required of us, one of those prices that we are going to have to consider, and that's what Christ is asking his followers to do here, consider the price you're going to have to pay. And it's something that applies to us today also. One of those things he's asking them to consider is simply this, that we must love God and Jesus Christ more than any other person that we know, that we can ever come in contact with. The personalities, the deity of God and of Jesus Christ have to be first in our life. We cannot love anyone more than we love them. Now, I believe that what Christ is saying here, giving these commands to those that would be his disciples, and counting the cost, he's not giving him a command that would contradict other expressions of love that we as his disciples must manifest in our life. By using a negative, we can learn something from what Paul had to say in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. Again, this is a passage that we have heard many times before. He says, "But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially those of his household, He has denied the faith and worse than an infidel. The love that we have for God, and that being primary and most important in our life, does not mean then that this gives us an excuse not to provide for our own. Because we see we still have obligations one toward the other. And so when God says, put me first, that doesn't mean that I don't do other things for other people, or I cannot manifest my love for them in some way. In John 19, verses 26 and 27, we find also as Christ is there on the cross, he looks down and he sees John and he sees his mother, and he talks about this disciple whom Christ loved. That didn't mean that he loved this particular disciple more than all the others or placed him above all the others. He still loved and died for all of his followers. It's just an expression that is used, and he is telling John there to take care of my mother. That didn't mean that John did not have an obligation to Christ. And by saying that John is to love Christ more than anybody else, it didn't mean that he didn't have an obligation toward Mary. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verses 1 through 4, we find instruction to parents there concerning the raising of their children and also the obligation that children have towards parents. These obligations do not negate, they do not contradict our love for God. Our love for God does not negate these commands either. That's what Christ is trying to say here. When we put God first and when we put Christ first, then we're going to fulfill all these other obligations that we have toward other individuals. As we read in the passage also, we find what Christ had to say here. If you do not hate your father and mother and your sons and daughters and brothers and sisters more than me, then you're not my disciple. In this particular way, he's not saying that we are to despise these individuals. But he's simply saying, and I believe it is, you know, it's correct to say, that we just love them less. They are not the priority on our list. Again, in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 37, a parallel account of what Christ is saying there, he says concerning our love, and we read this morning, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. So he's not contradicting himself in one passage saying you've got to hate these individuals. But what he's saying is we love them less. They are not the priority in our life. They're not the ones that we are living for. We're not following them and being their disciples. But in order to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, what we must do is count the cost. And the cost that he demands of us is putting him first above everybody. In regards to others, as we read here in this passage, Jesus speaks of four kinds of loves that we have in our life. We manifest one toward the other. He talks about the love that we have for father and for mother. And you know, this is the first love that we experience in life. As we see, we come to realize the love that our parents have for us in providing for us the things that we have. And we as children, when we realize this, and we see the expression of their love, we want to try to return that love from ourselves. And children will do this in many ways. There's many a picture that has hung on the front of a refrigerator that some 2 or 3 year old has drawn and placed there because this is what they did for their mother or their father. It was an expression of their love for their parents. And it's an expression also of the love that the parents had for the children. And a young child wants to so much express their love for their parents. And parents love their children. That's one kind of love that he speaks of here. This first in our life that comes first to us. He also talks about the love of a husband or a wife. And this is, I believe, the closest bond that does exist between two human beings. And I believe that's the way that God intended for it to be. That this kind of love brings two people closer together than any other kind of love that we can demonstrate in our life. And we find that in the case of what God is saying, what Christ is saying, concerning the love between a husband and wife, it's shown in a parallel between Christ and the church in Ephesians, the 5th chapter. As we see there that Christ loved the church so much that he was willing, and he did, give up his life so that the church might have life. And that in return for that, that the church then submits totally and wholly unto Jesus Christ as the head. And in the passage we find that that's the way that the love between a husband and wife ought to be. That the husband is to love his wife so much that he would give up his life. And that the wife is to love her husband so much that she would submit herself unto him. This is the kind of love that is expressed in this passage that we're talking about in Luke. He also talks about the love for children. And this is yet another exercise of love that we find in our life. There are many parents, and I would say that there would be everyone in this audience this evening would, as a parent, be willing to give up their own life for their children. That if it came down between a choice of my life and the life of my children, then I would give my life for them. That's the kind of love that a father and a mother expresses for their children. He also talks about the love that exists between brothers and brothers and sisters and brothers and sisters. This is the love in the family relationship. And it's one of the strongest ones that we can demonstrate in our life. These express then some of the strongest ties that there is in family relationships, in human relationships. These are the things that really tie people together. This kind of love. Love for father and mother, husband, wife, children, brothers and sisters. And Christ is saying here that the cost you're going to have to pay, the cost of discipleship in following me, is that you're going to have to put me above all of that love that you experience toward other human beings. The love that God expressed to man through Jesus Christ certainly exceeds all of these loves that we see. Parental love, the love that exists between husband and wife, love for children and brotherly love. Parents, spouse, children, brothers and sisters, all of these are very, very dear to us. We would give our life probably in most of these instances. But they cannot be more dear to us than the love that we have for God and for Jesus Christ. All of these loves cannot exceed our love for God. And I'm not talking about, as we think of this, that somebody might say, well, you know, I love God more than I love, and I'm willing to do that more than my father and my mother. Or I'm willing to love God more than I am my husband or wife. Or I'm willing to love God more than my children or more than my brothers and sisters. But if you want to put all those together, I don't know if I have the kind of love for Christ that would exceed all the loves and the sums of those loves. What Christ is saying is that we take all those loves together and we add them together and we total them. That love cannot exceed our love for God. Our love for Jesus Christ. That's the cost that we're going to have to pay in being his disciple. We can see examples of what we would just term misplaced love. For example, in Eli's children. We know the story of Eli's children, that he was a prophet, he was a priest, and his sons were going to follow in his stead. But in 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 29, one of the things that God charges Samuel with is this. He says, you have honored your sons more than me. What had Eli done? Eli had honored his sons more than he had honored God. He had honored their wishes, their desires, the way that they wanted to live. He did not correct them. He did not control them as a father should. And as a result of that, Eli failed, and God said, you have honored your sons more than me. And I'm afraid that there's a lot of people in the world who are like that today. Some Christians follow that pattern, that they honor their children a whole lot more than they honor God. And they give in to their children rather than controlling them, rather than disciplining them. They allow them to do whatever they want to do. They don't follow God's commands in that relationship. but they let the children do what they want to do. We find the example of the Israelites, and it is said in Judges 2, verse 10, that another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord. And I wonder why a generation arose that did not know the Lord. Was the law taken away from the children of Israel? Did they all of a sudden forget what God wanted them to do? I believe the main reason that another generation arose that did not know God was that parents failed to teach their children. It was not that the law was taken away. It was just simply the fact that, as it may be in the case of Eli, they honored their children more than they did God. It's misplaced love. That fact that, you know, they were supposed to love their children, well, did not go missing in their life, but they had misplaced love. They did not love God. They were not willing to do that more than their children. And I believe that in our generation, we have seen exactly the same thing. We have seen husbands or wives forsake the Lord because of the love that they had for their spouse, that it was more than what they had for God, that they were willing to give up God before they gave up their husband or wife. We have seen children deny the truth because of the love that they had for their parents. We've seen parents being influenced by the thinking of their children, and as a result of that, they become conformed to worldly views. We've seen brothers and sisters compromise the truth for the sake of family harmony, of getting along, of having peace within the family unit. All kinds of family relationships arise which demonstrate the strength of our love for God. And in these relationships, we are supposed to place God above everyone else. Again, that's what Christ is saying in the passage here. In Luke chapter 14 and verse 26, he simply makes that statement. You've got to love me more. That's the cost of discipleship. But he goes on beyond that. And he also says that we must love God, we must love Jesus Christ, more than we love ourselves. More than we love ourselves. And I'm convinced that most of mankind, for most of mankind, Satan had the right estimation of man. We remember the story of Job, how that Satan came before God and he wanted to tell him, he wanted to test Job to see how strong his faith was. And he took everything, all the possessions away from him. And finally, as he saw that Job was not going to give in to that and curse God and die, what Satan said to God is, let me take his health away from him. Let me threaten his life. And he makes the statement in Job 2 and verse 4. And Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. And I'm convinced that for most of mankind, that's the philosophy that they live by. You threaten to take their life and they will do anything to preserve their life. Man will suffer the loss of almost everything that he has. But when you begin to threaten his life, again, I believe he'll do almost anything to preserve it. Many have renounced what they believe in order to save their physical life. You know, we hear the stories of the wonderful martyrs in the first century about how they were willing to die before they denied Jesus Christ. And they were willing to face the lions or whatever it might be, to be crucified or however they were going to die. We hear those wonderful stories. But I'm also convinced that there were those who did deny Christ. Those who, instead of dying, instead of giving up their physical life, denied their Lord and Master. We notice in Job the attitude that he had. And it's an attitude that I'm convinced that we must develop. Job, in the 13th chapter, in verse 15, makes this statement concerning God, after his friends had come to him and told him to repent because you've done something wrong. Job makes the statement, though he slay me, yet I will trust in him. That's kind of an attitude we have to have. Though God decides to slay me, he decides for my life to come to an end. Job says, I'm going to trust in him anyway. There's another attitude that we can see in Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and in Daniel, the third chapter. And it's always been a favorite passage in the Old Testament of mine. In the third chapter, in verses 17 and 18, here again, we must develop this kind of an attitude in our life. As they were about to be thrown by King Nebuchadnezzar into the fire, makes the statement, if that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But then they go on, that's not all they said. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. That's the attitude we ought to have. That even though our life might be taken, we're not going to forsake God. That even though someone tries to kill us, and we believe that God is allowing that to happen, that we're not going to put that trust in anything else. That we're always going to be faithful unto him, and we're going to trust in him. We must love God more than ourselves. The disciples of Christ, those in the first century and those of us who follow Christ today, I am convinced must possess the spirit of a martyr. We must be willing to give up all for the cause of Christ. We must be willing to give up whatever right we might have. And you know, that's just the opposite of what we're taught in our society today. That you don't give up your rights for anything or for anybody. If you want to hold on to them, then you have a right to hold on to those freedoms. The disciple of Jesus Christ should have the spirit of a martyr. To be willing to give up whatever he or she has to be pleasing to Christ. You know, those in the first century did. We can read of Stephen in Acts 7, of James over in Acts 12, of a saint by the name of Antipas at the church at Pergamos in Revelation chapter 2. We can read what Paul did and what he gave up and what he was willing to do as he counted his life nothing. Willing to be crucified with Christ. That's the kind of attitude in the spirit that we must develop. We must love God more than ourselves. If our love for these things in our life is greater than our love for Christ and our love for God, then as Christ said in Matthew 10 and verse 37, that person is not worthy of me. And you know, in a certain sense of the word then, we can be worthy of this. Not that we've earned anything by what we have done, but God declares us as being worthy by giving up all for him. And if we're not going to do that, if we're not willing to do that, then Jesus says, you're not worthy of me. A proper relationship with Christ is worth more than all of these other loves combined that we talked about. And as precious as we might hold family, father, mother, husband, wife, children, brothers, sisters, and as precious and dear as we might hold ourselves and our own life, Christ is worthy of the greatest love that we can offer. But there's more for us to consider in what Christ said here. Not only did he say we must love him more than other people, that we must love him more than we love ourselves. But he also says in that passage that we have a cross that we are to bear. This cross that he speaks of is not in reference to some wooden cross that we want to hang around our necks, some metal cross that we want to put there that's an ornament for a lot of people. That's not what he's talking about. I don't believe that it's even the normal hardships that come to everybody. You know, all of mankind suffers things together. We all suffer disease. We all suffer sickness. There are things in our life that are persecutions, hardships that come. And they're going to come whether you're a Christian or not. They're going to come whether you believe in God or not. That's not the kind of cross. That's not the kind of burden that he is speaking of here. It's not even the weaknesses that we have. And all of us manifest weaknesses from time to time. But this cross that he speaks of is a burden. It is a task, if you will. It's an obligation that we have, and that we have the right, we have the power to either refuse this burden or this cross, or we can accept it. It's all up to us. This cross, this burden, is not some unavoidable task that is going to come to us, regardless of what we choose. It's not something that we can, that we just simply cannot get out of. Someone has expressed it in this way, that the cross that we bear, the burden that is ours, simply means doing a thing which is disagreeable to do, or bearing a thing that was painful to bear, just because it was right. Just because it was right to do so. Not that we had to, but because it was the right thing to do. Although it was disagreeable and although it was painful. The cross we know of Christ was an object of ridicule and shame. Under the law of Moses in Deuteronomy 21 and verse 23, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. But this cross that we must bear is not the cross of Christ either. This cross that we must bear, I believe, is a personal cross. This cross is there because we are children of God. Because we have made the decision to follow Christ, to follow God, to be His disciple. We have forsaken all to follow Him. And we give all in obedience unto His will. It's that thing that the world, when they look at it, thinks how ridiculous that is. How ridiculous it is for a child of God to deny themselves these things in life that life offers. They think how ridiculous. And they make fun of it. And to some of them, it's a shame. You know, why do you want to give up that? Again, this is from the viewpoint of the world. They think how ridiculous for an individual who calls himself a Christian, who wants to follow Christ, and yet has the choice to make the right to make those choices. Why would they want to deny themselves of these things? When one is obedient to the will of God, when it becomes His own, when God's will becomes our will, there is going to be a cross that we have to bear. There is a burden that we have to take. Jesus told of the cross that His disciples were to bear. In John 16 and verse 2, as we read this morning, He gave a warning to them. They shall put you out of the synagogues, yea, the time comes when even those who kill you will think that they're doing God a service. That's the kind of cross we're going to have to bear. That's the kind of thing that we're going to have to put up with, being persecuted. That is the burden, that is the cross that He speaks of here. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 11, He says there, blessed are you when you are persecuted, when you're reviled by men. He says, they did also the prophets of old. That's the kind of cross we're going to have to bear. That's the kind of thing that we're going to have to put up with. And that's the price we're going to have to consider in being a follower of Jesus Christ. Peter talks about it in 1 Peter chapter 4, in verses 12 through 16. As we can read there what he says, beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when His glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you. For the Spirit of glory and of God rest upon you. On their part He is blasphemed, but on your part He is glorified. Let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer, or as a busybody in other people's matters. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this matter. A warning here concerning the cross that we are to bear. Things we're going to have to put up with and endure in this life because we have made the decision that we are willing to pay the price to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. There's warnings also about those individuals that would be followers of Christ in name only. Matthew 7 and verse 21. He speaks there and says, "Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father who is in heaven." So just being a disciple in name only is not enough. We've got to follow him. And the reward for those who do bear their cross, Christ says in Matthew 10 and verse 32, "Whoever therefore shall confess me before men, him I will also confess before my Father, which is in heaven." That's the reward that we have of confessing Christ, of paying that price and willingly counting that cost and giving it. In bearing the cross, we learn self-restraint. We learn self-denial. And this is something that's correct in the sight of God. This may be something that's shameful in the eyes of the world, to deny yourself, to restrain yourself from certain pleasures. But in order to please God, that's the price that we're going to have to pay. The true disciple is revealed in how he deals with this cross that he must bear. He can decide to reject it. He can leave it where it is and say the price is too much, or he can bear it. He can bear up and get strength even under the load of that great cross that we must bear. Will we bear the cross? Will we suffer for Christ? Will we pay the price willingly? All of this, as we see here what Christ had to say in these two short verses, it sounds pretty hard to do. It sounds pretty hard to love him more than everybody else and to bear up under this cross that we have been given because we are his disciples. And someone might ask, as we did this morning in the lesson, what am I going to get in return for that? There's a lot of people who will say concerning the life that they're trying to live is simply this: let me live my life on my terms. After all, I'm not such a bad person. You know, I maybe have a few vices. There's a few sins that I commit. But I'm not like a lot of these other people out in the world. I'm a pretty good person. So let me live my life the way I want to. And then simply they'll say, I'll just take my chances at judgment. Just let God give me what I deserve. We don't want what we deserve. It's just that simple. Because the first sin that we commit separates ourselves from God. And that means we're going to be eternally separated from him as long as that sin remains. We don't want what we deserve. We want what God has offered to us through Jesus Christ, his Son. When we commit sin, it is like committing a crime for which there is only one penalty, and that penalty is death. You know, we may have the concept of judgment of God kind of like we do in things here on this earth. We have a justice system that basically says the punishment should fit the crime, and if the crime is not bad, the punishment won't be bad. And there's only a few crimes that we can commit that will bring about the death penalty. But any sin that we commit, how great or how small, the penalty for that sin is death. And we need to think of sin in that way. And there is only one way, one just way, to deal with such a crime as that, such a sin as that. And that is to forfeit our life. We can pay for the sins we commit by giving our eternal soul. But what a price that is to pay when God has offered unto us an alternative. We don't have to do that. He has given us a choice. We don't have to die for our sins. We can have sins removed because there was someone who died for us. Instead of surrendering our lives, we need to surrender our lives to God instead of to Satan. And in so doing, we will enjoy those things that God can provide for us, not only here, but also in eternity. All those blessings that he will shower on those that are faithful. It is unfortunate, but I'm convinced that the mass majority of souls who live and who have lived cannot see beyond the physical existence that they have. And they had rather enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season and then be cast into outer darkness, away from God and His presence, in a place that is described as unquenchable fire throughout all eternity, than to pay the price here and to follow Jesus Christ. What they are forfeiting, I don't believe they will truly understand until it's too late. But we don't have to do that, because God has revealed unto us what sin does and the remedy for sin. Don't just, as we strive to be disciples, don't just count the cost, but be willing also to pay the price. Because you see, the return for that investment will be far greater than your greatest expectations and the greatest hopes that you have. Christ said in Matthew 10 and verse 39, in conclusion to warning His disciples and giving them instructions, He says, "He that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loses his life for my sake shall find it." And that's what we need to do. We need to forfeit our life. We need to give it up for the cause of Christ. And in so doing, we will be blessed far beyond anything that we can think of. For God then, through Jesus Christ, will give us an eternal home with Him. But we must count the cost. Are you willing to pay that price? Are you willing to give up all that God says that you must do in order to be pleasing to Him? Are you willing to do all those things that He calls upon you to do? And as the verses express, are you willing to love Him more than anybody else? More than yourself? Are you willing to bear that cross that is going to come upon you because of a decision that you have made? That's the price we have to pay. That's what we have to consider. But once again, when we consider the alternative, there shouldn't be any choice at all. It should be made for us. Will you pay the price? If you're not a child of God, this is something you have to consider. You have to consider, am I willing to do what God says? And this is not something that, you know, we use to try to scare people away. Because this is what Christ said. Consider the price. Consider what you're going to have to do. Are you willing to do that? If you're here this evening and not a child of God, are you willing to have faith and express that faith in repentance, confession, and baptism for the remission of your sins? That's what He calls upon you to do. It's part of the price you have to pay. Are you willing then to live faithfully the remainder of your life, however many years you might have, in service unto Him? Again, consider those things. And consider also the alternative. Song has been selected. Would you obey Christ this evening? Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?